Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Life Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4, for Spring Semester 2020. Lecture 19, delivered on February 26th.
Tonight, structure of interest rates. Before we begin that, we'll have a look at the markets. As you can see, it's calmed down considerably. There was still a loss on the heavies, the Dow 30 and the S&P 500, but they were not dramatic as they have been. And the NASDAQ was up a little bit today. So we see that, in general, news of the death of the stock market was a little premature. That's quite normal. There's actually a term. It's called bounce on the drop, where you'll have a pretty heavy drop, and then there's sort of a recovery that happens as bargain hunters come in and grab up undervalued stocks. And also, as I do, I go in and I harvest for securities that were actually shouldn't have dropped at all. They should have gone up. And so I grab those up because they really will go up, as happened with one stock I grabbed this morning, which by the time the markets opened, that was starting to rise, and it's actually risen about 30% over the day. That's not a bad day on just that one. In general, as I've said before, even in a hurricane down market, bad news is opportunity. Don't ever think the bad news is just bad news for everybody. And I could even show you, I'm taking advantage of the fact that there's a very bad virus which could go pandemic. No, I'm not betting on death. I'm betting on capitalism to find companies that want to profit, and they'll do whatever they can to cure the damn thing. So don't always think that the end of the world is coming. It's coming for those who are not prepared adequately. But if we look across here, we did have some downstroke. And over here on the bonds, they did take a little bit of a beating today, and we're going to talk more about that in the lecture tonight. When bond prices go down, that means that the yields on bonds are going up because there's a perfect mathematical inverse relationship between price and yield. Bonds go down, yields go up, and bond prices go down. And so in this case, we see that there is upward pressure on interest rates. That is generally a sign of risk being impounded. And as you'll see that just in a little while in what's called the risk structure of an interest rate. So it's not surprising that they're going down. So we go back over here, and of course, there is a flight to quality. It's not anything significant, but there is money flowing into gold. And also, generally speaking, you don't need to be buying gold itself. That's actually kind of stupid to do. You have these gold people that are collecting gold bullion and gold bars and stuff. You don't need to do that. Generally, if you want to invest in gold, if you think gold is going to be strong, you go for gold mining stocks. The mining stocks tend to move with the gold itself. And also, you go into companies that do hoard gold. Because those companies, if you buy stock, you're an owner of a company that owns gold. So as those companies gather gold, you gather value if you think gold is going to go up in price. It's speculative. Don't get me wrong. Those are risky. Those can be risky as hell, but they are out there. And as a matter of fact, there are some mutual funds that are heavily tilted toward gold mining and gold stocks. And so you can play it that way, too. So there are ways, if you're a gold person, don't get involved with those fools online, the gold bugs, as we call them. If you want to take a position in it, that's fine. It's kind of like a hedge. Put a little money into those stocks, so if the stock market goes down, those will probably not do badly at all. I have a position in a mutual fund that's tilted toward gold mining companies. It did pretty well. It's not doing anything spectacular, don't get me wrong about that, but it has improved somewhat during this downstroke in the market. So there's that. It's an opportunity. Don't ever panic like everyone else. That's the whole point. One of the things, and I've mentioned this before, in the theory of war is you keep disciplined. That's why we do such brutal training, so that you stay disciplined and you create chaos, which causes your enemy to panic. Let them go into chaos and they'll all get routed and you'll come out just fine. Now, that's enough of that kind of talk here for a little while. But again, not the worst day in the world, but we're still suffering. And we probably will see some more. Although, just as a guess, I would say that the worst of it, do you see that drop there at the end? It just dropped off a cliff there at the end, the S&P 500 did. So there's still negativity in the market, and that'll probably spill over into Thursday. But don't expect too much more horror in the market, although we could still have some down strokes over the next few days. So there's that. Bear with me here. Well, did I walk right out without my markers? I'll bet I did, and there are no markers here. The marker thieves have come through and taken all of the markers away. I've got a green marker here, which is kind of not the best thing in the world. Oh, well, it'll do. I'm hopeful that you can see that. I'll be talking as I write so that you can see it as well. Okay, now, I'm going to tell you a story tonight. It's the history of the economy of the United States from the mid-1950s. But I will hold that off until I get the background of it, what actually was happening behind the scenes. Let me show you. Okay, now, if there is an interest rate, R, what we're talking about, whether it's a loan, the interest rate on a car loan, a home loan, a student loan, a yield on a bond, whatever it is, that interest rate is driven by pieces. Now, the one I showed you the last time was the risk-free rate, R sub F. This thing actually has the two pieces in it. The two pieces of it are the real rate of return and an expected inflation premium. R sub real plus pi E. A couple of things. The real interest rate, as I said, we can't see it. It's one of those things, it's hidden inside of something bigger. And so we have to essentially tease it out by statistical analysis, what it actually is. But we do, of course, understand that if we have supply and demand for money, then this real interest rate, the actual cost of money, the opportunity cost of foregone consumption is driven by the supply of and the demand for money. It's just supply and demand dynamics. If more money is pushed in, well, actually, now in your macro classes, they show the supply curve. And I'll draw it that way just for the consistency with how they show it in economics classes. You might recall that they actually showed the supply curve as perfectly inelastic at any given time. In other words, there's just a pile of money out there. It doesn't move up and down by the normal dynamics. It's just an amount of money. So, and then where the supply and the demand meet, equilibrium is established. The quantity supplied is the same as the quantity demanded, and that sets a real interest rate at any given point in time, given a demand curve and the supply curve, the supply of money. Nothing complicated about that. That's just old macro stuff. And so if the Fed wants interest rates to go down, it leverages on this real rate by pushing money into the economy. Oops, that's supply one. It would push the money supply outward. And that's through open market operations. The Fed, the FOMC, the Federal Open Market Committee, decides, okay, we want to cause interest rates to go down to stimulate the economy. Well, what they would do is then they would call the open market, the domestic trading desk, and say, all right, traders, call banks and pay them money for their treasury bills. In other words, they inject liquidity into the overnight markets. And so the traders would do that. And that's what they've been doing. For the fancy term they're using now, you might have heard at some point in the past, it's called quantitative easing. It's just a fancy term for they're dumping money into the economy to make interest rates go down and stimulate the economy. They did, the short name for it is QE. After the crash in 2008, they did round after round of QE. There was QE1, QE2, QE3. It was, you know, just kept pouring money in to wake up the economy. Eventually it did, and we began a real recovery about we began to crawl out through quantitative easing, and also Congress passed this big money bill in 2009, and those forces together started to get the economy waking up in about 2011. By 2012, the economy was strong. It was doing okay again. And we have had a darn nice expansion of the economy, high job growth rate. Since then, low expected inflation, et cetera, et cetera. So we've been in kind of a golden time. There were indications that fractures that were never dealt with were starting to show up again. And by last year, we were seeing that the Fed was injecting quietly because there was heavy liquidity drains. It was almost as if this supply curve that had been boosted so much for so many years was suddenly doing what it did in September of 2008. It was coming back this way for almost no known reason. There was what we call liquidity drain. Just the money was disappearing from the overnight markets. This started seriously in September. Well, the Fed saw it and quickly reacted more to it, just poured money in. They bought up treasury bills, these things called repurchase agreements, repos from banks. And so it looked like, well, that was weird. Well, damned if it didn't keep happening. It just kept, the money just disappeared. And so the Fed funds rate was going up. That's an overnight market where banks lend to each other. The real rate kept trying to come back up like this. The Fed has just kept throwing money in, one after the other. As I said, to the tune right now, since September, maybe $2 trillion. And it's to keep the markets from buckling. If there's not enough liquidity, it's just like an engine without enough oil. It just goes pop like that. What's causing that? There's a lot of speculation. I mean, I'm a conspiracy theorist. I strongly suspect that money is disappearing into the dark markets behind the scenes, where you don't see the volume on the books of transactions and securities. They're all private, quiet things. I don't know, though. That's just me being a conspiracy theorist. But anyway, as you can see, if the Fed pours money into the economy, well, that will bring down the real interest rate like that. Similarly, a contraction of the money supply would cause interest rates to go up. There's a danger in this, though, you see, because inflation is driven by too much money in an economy. That's really the only way inflation can take a hold. There are all these things, well, if we raise the minimum wage, that'll be inflationary. No, it won't. If you don't change the money supply, all that would do is drive down, that would drive down prices in other markets because they couldn't afford both workers and other things. Or these companies are raising their prices, that's inflationary. No, again, if there's no extra money to monetize that price shock, well, it's going to not cause inflation. It's just going to maybe cause a recession or something like that. But no, those aren't what causes inflation. Inflation has really one cause only: too much money being created relative to the real growth of the economy. You see, if an economy grows at 3%, you're going to need 3% more money to provide sufficient liquidity. It's all very simple. What makes it complicated is when the Fed tries to help the economy or hurt the economy by causing the money supply to change its growth path. In fact, 2008, and I will do this in a subsequent lecture, the real underlying cause of that big crash, no, it wasn't some bubble and some that stupid-ass word bubble. It was simply because the Fed had stopped producing enough money to sustain the economy's growth rate. I mean, I can show you the graph. It was stunning. The real growth rate of the money supply was about zero for 4 or 5 years. And, of course, the economy was growing, and finally the economy just buckled like a machine that wasn't getting enough oil for the growth for its real growth. We'll get into that a little later, but here's the problem. Inflation isn't the problem. It's this son of a dog right here, expected inflation. Because once expected inflation gets in, it's hard to shake it out. It's like the economy gets this mindset that we must raise prices. Even when the Fed says, well, we're going to contract the money supply, so don't worry. If the Fed doesn't come through with that, the markets start to disbelieve the Fed, and they start putting more and more price increases in. Think about it this way. Madam, I am your new employer. I'm going to be really generous with my salary to $100 a month. Yes, indeed. You're welcome. Well, now, you come in for your annual review after a year, and I say, you're a damn fine employee. Great. Well, inflation last year was running at 2%, so I'm going to give you a 2% raise. There you go. Now get back to work, damn it. Okay? Well, for one thing, that sucks right there. You see, because she's already experienced the price shock of 2%, and then she gets 2%. So that sucks right there. Okay, now you come back in the next year, and I say, oh, well, you're still doing great. Well, I see inflation last year was 4%, so I'm going to give you a 4% raise. There you go. Get back to work. Go. Scoot. Okay, next year. Well, you're still doing good. I see inflation last year was 6%, so I'm going to give you a 6% raise. Get back to work. Go. You this time say, stop it, fat boy. I hate it when people call me fat boy. Stop it, fat boy. What do you really want? You had inflation 2%, 4%, 6%. What would compensate you for the next year? Whoa, you're getting greedy there. Oh, about 8%. Let's say, 2, 4, 6, 8%. You see, I'm paying you behind the curve. The expectation you would have is ahead of the curve, so that you would be taken care of for what's going to happen. That's how financial markets work. That's how logical people work. They think, what's going to happen next? Because if I give you that 6% raise, that fixes the problem that already happened to you. That's shooting you and then giving you Kevlar. Now, you understand that this is how financial markets think. They don't care what has happened. What they care about is what they expect to happen next. If I make a loan to you, a home loan of, let's say, 7% real, I'm not impounding the inflation premium that's already happened. I've got to look at what I expect to happen over the life of that loan, what's forward. Otherwise, my return on that is eroded by inflation. That's why we have this expected inflation premium sitting here. And that's what can cause real havoc in a market, is when inflation just keeps going, even when the Fed says, we're going to fix the inflation. If the markets begin to expect worse and worse, they'll put it in no matter what the Fed is trying to do to stop the inflation. And then, well, I'll get into that. This is not theory. Well, it's theory, but it's also very real. It actually almost, well, it created one of the worst situations, aside from the Great Recession, since World War II. It happened just before your lifetime, this cycle of near disaster, because the Fed kept promising to fix inflation, presidents kept promising to fix inflation, and yet they kept printing more and more money to stay ahead of what was happening. You see, here's the problem. In the short run, if the Fed increases the money supply, well, the real rate goes, supply of money goes up. The real rate goes down, supply and demand, and expectations of inflation stay kind of flat. But if the Fed keeps doing that, eventually the expected inflation premium will start to go up, even though the real rate is lower. So the Fed says, oh, interest rates have gone up, so we're going to push it up again. So that drives down the real rate temporarily, but then ultimately expected inflation kicks in again for a higher expected inflation rate. This is what was happening in the 1970s, and it led to a near disaster by the end of the 70s. Ultimately, there's this short run. Push down, add money to the economy, interest rates go down. Wonderful. But the long term is, if you keep doing that, those lower interest rates are going to start to go back up because expected inflation starts to embed. We expect the Fed to lie to us, and therefore we're going to jack up our prices in advance of the coming inflation that will be caused by that printing of money. And it was like a vicious cycle. It really started, the disaster started actually in the Kennedy administration. And we didn't really notice it, because when an economy has a lot of latent productivity that's not being used, you can put a lot of money into an economy and you won't create inflation. It's sort of like you're filling a hole in the economy. This is what happened with China. China just printed money hand over fist from the mid-1990s until very recently. And it didn't cause significant inflation just because there was so much latent productivity in that massive country. The same happened here, and it's still happening. There was a long time when we could print money, and we weren't creating any noticeable inflation, just because after the war, we had all of these people who were well-trained, we had women entering the workforce, we had new technologies, we had all these factories that had been building everything from artillery guns to bombers and trucks. So we had huge latent capacity, so we could print money, and we didn't create a lot of inflation because the money just made us go full again. It's like if you've been starving for a long time, eating a huge meal at some all-you-can-eat buffet like I do isn't going to hurt you. It's only if you just keep doing that after you've gotten your weight back that it starts to cause problems. So I'm going to tell you that story, though. It's not hugely long, but it is something that most people anymore, they just, even the people who lived through it, really never understood what was going on behind the scenes. But let me get over here and finish this piece up. So if I had a real rate of let's say 2% and an expected inflation premium of let's say 3%, then the risk-free rate would be 2% plus 3%, which would be 5%.
Technically, this isn't actually correct. It's fine to do it this way for most purposes, but there is actually a more accurate way of calculating it. It's called the Fisher effect, and I'm not sure the book actually calls it this, but that's its technical name. Interest rates aren't actually additive. They're multiplicative. I'll show you how you would technically calculate it. You would do 1 plus 0.02 times 1 plus 0.03 minus 1. Technically, that's how you would do it. The Fisher effect recognizes compounding, essentially. As you remember, compounding is when you multiply or take exponents. So if I were to do it that way, and you'll see that the difference is very minor, especially for low interest rates. So I do 1.02 times 1.03 minus 1, 5.06%. So in other words, as you can see, it's not a significant difference. For low interest rates for short periods of time. If you're talking about higher interest rates and or longer periods of time, it's actually more significant. And so if you are the kind of person who says, gosh, I love finance, I'm going to take more courses with Professor C, I would show you this Fisher effect and how we can see things that would not otherwise be seen. And I'll show you a problem that you'll get in your homework, very similar to this, is when we have, let's say, a one-year T-bill is coming off at 1.50%, and a two-year T-note is coming off at 1.65%. Inside of here is a secret hiding piece of information. Because this two-year note is saying overall what our interest rate's going to do over the next 2 years. But we can tease out what the markets think they're going to be doing from year one to year two. This is called a forward rate, and it tells us more about expectations year by year than this composite 1.65% would do. I'll show you what I mean by this. Look, that one-year T-bill rate is actually two things. It's a one-year rate, 1 plus 0.015, times another forward rate for year one to two, 1 plus X. The X is, again, called a forward rate. But their composite is 1 plus 0.0165 compounded two periods. Just write this down, follow this example in the problem, and you won't get it wrong. So what I would look at here is I would say, okay, then 1 plus x is 1.0165 squared over 1.015. I just took that and put it on the other side. That's all I did. So now I can say 1 plus x is, and I'm going to crank that out for you here real quick, so you get this 1.0165 squared divided by 1.015. Is that right? So 1 plus x
is 1.018. Now, so X, that 1 year forward rate, that forward rate is 0.018, which is 1.8%. Remember to take the one off it.
Oh, that's interesting. That's, see, that's that hidden little gem. Even though I see this 2 year rate is a little above the 1 year rate, that second year is actually pretty darn strongly above the 1 year rate. That forward rate is telling us that the markets actually think the interest rate is going to be 1.50%. But when you look at this, that means that they think that the 1 to 2 year rate is going to be 1.8%, which is noticeably more than the 1.65% you see in just a 2 year T-bill, T-note yield. That's that piece right there. It's nothing too complicated. Just follow what I did here and you'll get the answer right on the homework. Not complicated. The Fisher effect is useful, especially if you're in finance, we use it all the time. Honestly, though, if you're in about any other business field, you're going to take the additive way to get things, okay? And you're not going to worry about those forward rates in any other field of business. It's only in our field that we are interested in those, in finance and economics, because those can give us windows on what the market thinks is going to happen year by year instead of composites. You, sir, are going to be 90% healthy for the next 40 years. Okay? Actually, for 38 of those years, you're going to be 100%. And then there are going to be a couple of years when, man, you're a mess. I mean, you end up with diabetes, you got colon problems, the whole nine yards. So that's that thing. Knowing a composite doesn't tell you the individual components of it. Yeah, I don't mean that. I do. I mean, you may look healthy, but are you really? I went to my doctor. I said, doctor, it hurts when I do this. He said, well, then don't do that, you moron. Okay. Anyway, try to inject some humor into what do I get from you. Okay, look. Okay, this is all good and fine. All interest rates carry this risk-free rate. It's sort of like your foundation layer. You pour that on. You put down this concrete foundation. But then the question is, what are you going to put on that foundation? Are you going to put an apartment complex? Are you going to put on there a mall? Are you going to put on there a White Castle, which they need in this town? They don't have it. What is the matter with you? They need, anyway, or you're going to put a skyscraper. You see, the foundation will be there for all of them, this risk-free rate sitting there. And like I said, the worst part is that this is there, but we don't even see this directly. Worse yet, we don't see the pieces of it directly. We have to estimate them by statistical methods because every time we see an interest rate, it's already complicated in some way. So there's a risk-free rate hiding in it, but it's not sitting there. Here's the risk-free rate part of that interest rate you're seeing, and here's the other part. But we do have statistical methods to tease it out. And besides which, the risk-free rate, for all intents and purposes, is pretty much a rate on a short-term treasury bill, because T-bills are so riskless. And I'll pull that up again. And of course, if I had my bookmarks, this would be easier. Treasury. Try it, yield curve. Yeah, here we go, the daily yield curve.
Thanks.
Wait, was there money in there? Oh, darn it. Okay, you can see that a one-year T-bill right now is parked at about 1.26%. What's really scary, do you see how that yield curve is falling and falling and falling? And then it starts to turn around and starts rising. That's called an inverted yield curve. Normally, it should not happen. When it happens, it is a really bad sign. And this is the worst inversion of a yield curve I've ever seen in my life as a professional life. That one is just mind-boggling. And every recession in U.S. history has been preceded 6 to 9 months by an inverted yield curve. So in other words, this is flagging that there will probably be a recession. Now understand, as I said in the last lecture, sometimes a yield curve inverting will not lead to a recession, it will just lead to an economic pause. But every recession that's ever happened was preceded by an inverted yield curve. So in this case, well, this might mean we're just going to have an economic pause, but something this dramatic, this never before seen, is a clear warning sign. The problem is that the curve did not invert today or yesterday. It actually inverted near the end of last semester in my other class. I showed it then, and you had a few pundits saying, oh my God, it inverted. But then it came back to normal. The interest rates, the yields were going back up. And everyone said, oh, thank God, no recession. Well, actually, that's not true. Once it inverts, it can go back to normal, but the inversion has already happened. And that means the recession is coming. And them claiming, well, it was just a temporary thing, and now we're back to normal again, so there won't be. No, it inverted already. It inverted weirdly. The last time, it actually had a double inversion. It actually went down, and then it came back, and then it went down again. It was, I don't think I'd ever seen that one either. So, and this one's not messing around. This is just a full-blown inversion of the yield curve. Let me show you, and there's a site that I really like. Let me get Google back up here, and I'll go to a dynamic yield curve stock charts, I think, is the one that has it. Oh, quit it. That wasn't what I wanted. Is this it? There it is. This is the yield curve, okay, right now. Well, that's kind of weird. Now, watch, if you want to watch, this is actually not a very good representation of it. Matter of fact, this one is downright wrong. And it's going to freeze. Oh. Is there some reason this sucks? I'll bet they've disabled flash. They've disabled flash on this, so I can't do it. That's why it looks so weird. Okay. I was going to show you, stockcharts.com shows you the dynamic yield curve, but our IT people have knocked this down. Maybe I can show you one here, a dynamic yield curve. Oh, shut up. I don't want your stupid ads. Yield curve, current yield curve 2019. Well, that's current data.
That just irritates me, though. But they, I can't see this yield curve. Quit it. God, no, I don't want to shop now. Animate? Nope. They've killed it. I can't do it. But anyway, as you can see, oh, for heaven's sake, this is so out of date, this information. Apparently the last time I could use this, it's gone. But you could see what happened. The yield curve, it was supposed to show you what had been happening over the last 6 months. And you could see the yield curve was just sagging downward, and then it just inverted. Very bad news. Stay in college and stay away from people who have the coronavirus. That's my advice to you right now. No, don't thank me for that. Anyway, okay, enough of that. Let me take you here. Okay. Now we've got the foundation. You have this thing called the risk premium. It has three pieces to it. Now, I will caution you that this book uses very non-standard notation. And I'll point out what my standard notation is in the book. But it has three pieces to it. There is a default premium and a maturity premium and a liquidity premium. Or sometimes that last one is called the illiquidity premium. Now the book, calls R sub D, that's standard notation. So if you take any more finance courses or anything with finance in it, you would very likely see R sub D. Your book designates this DRP, the default risk premium, DRP, which is stupid, and they should have thought. They call the maturity premium R sub M. They call that MRP, the maturity risk premium, MRP. And the liquidity premium, R sub L, they call LRP, liquidity risk premium, LRP. So there's DERP, MERP, and LRP in the book. And that just feels so degrading to even say that for a serious, we're serious people in finance. You can tell that from me. Okay, now, these three pieces are characteristic of any given interest rate. In other words, one interest rate might have a big R sub D, default risk premium, but have nothing here. Another interest rate might have several of them big, one of them not there. One in particular that's of interest to us is the yield curve. You see, that's a yield on treasuries. Treasuries don't default. Treasuries, you can sell them in the blink of an eye, so there's no liquidity premium for not being able to get rid of it. So the only thing in a series of longer maturity treasuries is the maturity premium. So in other words, when we look at a yield curve, that is the effect of the maturity premium getting, in normal times, getting bigger as time goes on. Okay, now, default premium. This thing right here is just extra in case there's a default on the loan. Okay? There, you, sir, you are a very good credit risk. I am not. That means that I would probably get loans from high interest rate lenders. The default premium would be much larger. But it also has to do with the characteristic of the loan. For example, a home loan actually has a very low default premium, mainly because there's an underlying asset. If you default on your home loan, the bank can take the house. And the secret ingredient is that almost no one knows that in every home loan, well, not everyone, but almost all home loans, you as the borrower are paying an insurance premium that will make the lender whole if the house sells for less than the amount of the loan. So in other words, you default and you owe $180,000, but the bank gets a loan, gets a house that's worth only $170,000. The bank isn't out $10,000 because you were paying an insurance premium all along, so that this one of these loan guarantee companies, like one called Mortgage Assurance Guarantee Magic, they'll pay the $10,000 whole gap. Most people have no idea that they're paying an insurance premium. So these banks that cry crocodile tears about all the defaults on loans, that's total bullshit. And another thing, too, is that this is in any loan that is above 80% loan to value. However, people take out a loan, they make a 10% down payment. When they go below 80%, they have the right to order the bank to cancel that insurance premium. Most people don't know it's there, so they never cancel that insurance premium, even though they don't have to pay it anymore below 80% loan to value. It's one of those hidden secrets of banks, how they make extra bucks off people. And of course, the other thing is, you default on a loan, your credit is crap, you're treated like a dog for years trying to get anything else because you robbed a bank. Bull crap. You didn't rob them. They came out perfectly fine in most circumstances. And if they don't, it's their own stupidity. Anyway. Okay. Now, let's talk about a few other loans. A credit card, have you ever seen credit card interest rates can be stupidly high? 18.99% on this credit card, really? Well, the reason for that is, one, there's a higher default rate on credit cards. And the other thing is, there's no asset backing them. So they can't seize something of yours if you don't pay on it. Now, a car loan is kind of in the between area. Because technically, if you default on a car loan, they can take the car back. The problem for the auto loan company is that as soon as you drive a new car off the lot, it loses a nice little chunk of its value. So they'd be seizing an asset that was already, as soon as you drive the car off the lot, you are upside down on the loan. Now, let me make sure you understand that. Upside down means that the loan has a higher value than the asset it's backing. So in the first years that you have a car loan, you're upside down because if you borrowed all the money for a $20,000 car, as soon as you drive it off the lot, it's probably lost maybe $2,000 of its value, $18,000. So you're upside down for quite a while before you've paid off enough of it to be right side up again. This is a problem. You see home values. Generally, we like to say home values rise. So as soon as you get your loan, after you make a few payments, you're right side up. However, in a recession, when housing prices go down, you can very quickly end up upside down on a loan. And if you're upside down on a home loan, you have a whole lot of incentives to just walk away from the loan because you owe more than it's worth, and it will probably not recover its value for years. That's why you have default rates so high in recessions on homes. When they say, oh, there was a price bubble, look at all the... Oh, no, there wasn't. It was just normal finance. People were upside down. As soon as that recession hit, home prices dropped way below what the people owed on their homes, so rationally they walk away. It wasn't high prices of homes. It was just that those homes lost a lot of value very quickly. Now, the default premium, like I said, that's one of the big drivers of why interest rates on different kinds of loans and things like that are different. So, for example, a very high-quality corporation, great credit, its earnings is positive and strong. Growth rate of the company is doing good. Well, they can sell bonds that pay interest rate, what we call coupons, that are very low. However, if a company is very risky and there is a significant chance that they will default on part or all of their loan, then you'll see them, they'll be actually issuing junk bonds. high interest, they're paying a high interest on those because of the default premium here. Now, the next one here is called the maturity premium. This is the one, it's one of those damned if you do and damned if you don't kinds of things. Does anyone in here own a home? I didn't think so. Okay, you will someday. Trying to think here. You're the guy I'm going to do this to. You decide that you want to own your own home. You've been living with mom in the basement ever since you got your degree. What's your major?
Marketing.
Yes. Go out, erat demonstrandum. Okay. But you know, it's time for you to move on. You've got to have a home of your own. It is very awkward when you bring a friend home. You know, George. Who's that with you? No one, Mom. Don't lie to me, you fat boy. Okay. That's what happened to me. Oh, yeah. Joined the Army. Boy, that really helped things out. Anyway. Okay. But, okay. Now, here's the thing. I'm your lender. Now, if interest rates go down, I lend you at, let's say, on a fixed rate mortgage, a 30-year FRM, at let's say 6.5%. Now, you're going to make your payments. You're going to be a good, responsible person. What happens? I figure, 30 years, I'm going to get 6.5% off you. An investment, I'm sure of that, because you're a good credit risk and all that. Okay, now, what happens if interest rates on home mortgages fall to 4% sometime during the life of your loan? What are you going to do?
Try to get a new loan.
Yeah, you're going to refi. We call it refi. You're going to refinance. Hell, why would you pay 6.5? You'll just go to a bank that's offering 4 and use that money to pay off the other loan. And so I, as the banker who was expecting 6.5% from you, I get screwed because I get that money back, and now I can invest it at only 4%. So downside risk is there for me. But it's even worse. It's even worse. Because let's talk about life of loan. The typical home loan, especially for a first home loan buyer, the typical American family pays off that loan in 7 years, about 7 years. They move to a new place. In your case, at the 7-year mark, you've got this loan out there, but now you have a wife. You have her brother living with you, and your brother's moved in with his 5 kids, and then you had the neighbor fall on hard times, so he kicked his teenage daughter out, so she's living there. And you can't tell one from the other except for that girl, she's got piercings in her nose and eyeballs and that tattoo. Have you seen the tattoos on the eyeballs? That freaked me. Anyway, okay. So you see, you really need to move on. 7 years, that's typical. But now, at 7 years, interest rates have gone up to 12%. I, as a banker, am really excited. 7 years, that son of a dog is going to pay off that loan, and then I can reinvest that money at 12% in a new loan. What are you going to do? Are you going to move and take on a new loan, or are you just going to build a deep underground bunker, not for everyone else, but for yourself? That's right. You're not going to go. So you see, if interest rates go up, I, as a banker, am screwed. So in either case, interest rate volatility is my enemy. It's not so much you, but I need, for the longer a loan is, the more likely interest rates will go up or down. Doesn't matter, I'm hurt. So a loan of 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, interest rates aren't likely to move very much. So the maturity premium is going to be low. But when you get out there 10, 15, 20, 30, 50-year loans, my God, there's no doubt about it. Interest rates are going to move adversely to you, to me, the lender. So that's why the maturity premium in normal times grows like that. That is why the yield curve is normally, typically, upward sloping. It's just the maturity premium. Now, if that thing is arcing too hard, let me draw this out to you. I just put these little graphs there in your notes somewhere. This would be yields to maturity of different lengths of loan, like for the Treasury. So you'd have a 1 month, a 2 month, a 6 month. This x-axis is logarithmic, so that you don't have the 30 years way out here. It kind of compresses using logarithms, does that. And this is the yield on the Treasury. Typically, this is a very healthy, normal yield curve. The maturity premium, it arches upward at a very normal rate. Now, it's kind of subtle, and you'll have some disagreements. This one is also upward, but it's kind of unhealthy, because that's saying either there's extreme uncertainty about future interest rates, or more likely, that expected inflation premium is getting seriously nasty out there in the future. So that could cause too much of an arch. Now, how do you know the difference? When is it too much? When is it okay? It's a matter of experience with them. But in some cases, it's really obvious when that arc is way too strong. And then, of course, the one that I just showed you where we are now, that's the one, the inverted yield curve. That's the bad one. That's the bad boy. And once it inverts, if it just comes back to normal, that doesn't mean we're out of the woods. If I've shot you and then I don't shoot you anymore, you're okay? No, you're still a little bitchy at me. Okay? The one that was really weirding me out, and this was what was happening last semester when I was showing this, it did this. As a matter of fact, at one point, it actually did this. It was a double hump or a double dip. That wouldn't be that's a double dip. I'd never seen that one before. I mean, seriously. And, of course, the one I'm seeing now, I've never seen an inversion this deep and this long. Last semester, before it did that stupid thing right there, I mean, it was just a notch. But a notch is fine. It was between the 7 and 10-year yield. The 10-year was below the 7-year. And then it recovered, and then it notched between the 5 and the 7-year. And then it recovered. And then just a while back, it went into that serious thing right there. And then all of a sudden, pundits were peeing all over themselves saying, oh, my God, we might have a recession. But then you still have the pundits saying, don't worry about that. We see bright times ahead. And then you see the other thing. All of this terrible stock market, that's a coronavirus. The coronavirus wasn't an issue when that thing inverted. That is not the cause of what's coming. It's adding to it. It's scaring the hell out of the markets. But that is not what the core problem was. So when any politician, Republican or Democrat, says, don't blame me for this bad economy in 6 months, it was that coronavirus. No, the warning signs were coming before that nasty thing happened. So that just sort of accelerated it, made it worse, but it was already there. So that keep that in mind. Now, the liquidity premium. The liquidity premium is an extra amount if the loan you can't. If I, as a banker, banks sell loans all the time to investors, to other banks, to giant investment pools. That's a normal thing. As a matter of fact, when you take out a loan at a bank for a home, that bank doesn't have that loan for more than a day before it unloads that. It packages all of its loans that it makes, home loans it makes, in a given period of time, hours, a day, a couple of days, it balls them up into a big package and it sells it to what's called a secondary mortgage market. They have names like Ginny Mae, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac. These are super giant pools of thousands and thousands and thousands of loans. What the hell? Boy, that just pinches my boxers when. Okay. Is there anybody in there? Yes, Muffo! Anyway, okay, but they just ball them up. Now you say, but I still pay my bank the loan. No, they are actually just servicing the loan. They get a little fee for taking the payments. That's all it is. But they have dumped your loan like a hot potato. That's not their business. They don't hold those loans. They sell them, and there are different specialty markets, like Ginnie Mae is the GNMA, the Guaranteed Mortgage Guaranteed National Mortgage Association, Freddie Mac, Fannie Mae. There was one for student loans even. It was called Sallie Mae. And I don't even know if Sallie Mae is around anymore, since it is still around, because most of the loans are originating straight up from the government. But who buys these super giant packages of loans? Well, for one thing, who has millions and hundreds of millions of dollars to buy these loans? Give you three guesses, and they all start with capital C and end with A, five letters. Or another one, the Saudis, or giant trust funds in Europe and places like that in Canada. They create liquidity. If they didn't exist, that R sub L would be very high, and you would pay a lot more for your interest on your home loans, your car loans, your mortgage loans, in fact, all of them. Even more complicated is that these loans are divided up into parts so that they can take a giant package of loans and they can carve it into pieces. Okay, you guys are going to get the long-term payoffs of the early payoffs of the loans. You guys are going to get the principal part of the loan payment. You guys are going to, they carve them up. And even worse, these are turned into the underlyings for derivatives. They're called CDOs and CMOs. Those are the things that crashed like the Hindenburg in 2008. The credit derivative, the collateralized mortgage market. In other words, you can bet on where those interest rates are going to go. And the bet is backed by the loan itself. If the loan dies, then the bet dies. So if you unknowingly invested in the derivative and the loan dies, you suddenly lose everything. That is how scary it is. How bad is it now? Well, the last time we got into this mess, the credit derivative market lost $64 trillion in notional value. Just went away. And it's still sitting on the books of companies. They've still got these assets listed that have no value. They're zombies. How much do we have now on the books since we didn't learn our lesson last time? $64 trillion is laughable. We may be above half a quadrillion dollars this time. So if we crash, it is going to be a whole nother story. Now, I'm going to do one last thing here tonight. I'll have to pull this up for you. So bear with me while I get this thing up here. Sign in. You see, the one thing that I greatly appreciate is folks coming to my lecture on a cold night.
Yeah. Oh, don't you put, no. You can't tell me what to do, Professor. You're not my dad.
And once you're finished with that, that's all I have for you. I thank you.